Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, teaching Bitcoin part two with Michael Howell. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, Nick. Great to be here.
We have really enjoyed teaching Bitcoin to such an incredible student. And it really is an honor for me here to be teaching someone who's my rates mentor in many ways about Bitcoin. So thank you for agreeing to do this. Part one, we covered a little bit of the history of cryptography and introducing Bitcoin as an internet protocol first, not a company, not a counterparty. And that's the way that we want to set up Bitcoin. But we also gave the audience an introduction into whether Bitcoin is an asset or money. And we established that it is a little bit of both, but because we are experiencing a new technology, it's hard to exactly define it. But we hope, Michael, that you'll assist us as we get deeper into the entire mechanics of Bitcoin. So let's start today with public private key pairs, a little bit of cryptography, and introduce some of the underpinnings to what makes Bitcoin so special and unique. And now, when I talk about Bitcoin's cryptography, I should note, Michael, that you know I'm a finance practitioner. I'm not a computer scientist and definitely not an applied cryptographer. So please consider that. I have been teaching Bitcoin's cryptography from a finance perspective for many years. So I hope that this explanation will do just fine. So maybe you could just tell us your understanding of Bitcoin's cryptography, if you're starting from a certain place, so that I can make sure we're teaching it in the correct way.
Well, I think that I'd fess up, Nick, that I'm starting at pretty close to ground zero here. Well, I know I understand a little bit about the idea of public-private keys, why they're secure, a little bit about the maybe the paradoxes in terms of how to make sure that you don't get sort of doubling up on the currency. So I think we went through it a little bit last time. That was the That was the Byzantine problem.
Yes.
But you know, let's just assume that it's my knowledge is low. Put it that way.
Sure. And so the Byzantine generals problem is a communications problem in computer science. We've established that, but the cryptography behind Bitcoin, which is in part this public-private key pair relationship, is a 1970s phenomenon. And so when the cryptography field broke free of the NSA in the 1970s, the technology that allowed for the exchange of information in a private way became possible at the beginning with this public-private key pair. And Bitcoin relies on the technology, but the pair of keys, which allows a person to have a number, and that number is the private key. That private key can be derived offline by that person so that nobody ever has the knowledge of that number. And the odds of guessing that number, depending on the cryptography algorithm, can be up to 2 to the 256th power. So a number so large that it becomes, mathematically improbable to ever guess it. Then you send that number through an equation. And that's basically the concept that makes the most sense to me as a non-cryptographer. You send it through an equation. But the equation that you send it through cannot be reverse engineered. So in a way that when we see a left side and a right side of the equation, we can know that 2 + 6 = 8. But if we know 8, there are technically an infinite number of solutions to the left side of the equation to make it equal to 8. So in a similar way, obviously there is highly technical computer science involved here, but the equation itself is designed in a way that you can't go backwards. So what it allows us to do in the Bitcoin context is share an address, which actually goes through two of these equations. You turn a private key into a public key and a public key into an address. You share that address. Just like I share with you my email address, you can send me information, data to my email, but you can't read my email because you don't have the password to my email account. If you send me Bitcoin to my address, that is on the other side of this equation for which I own the private key. I derived it myself. Nobody knows it. And so if we're using a real life example and we're using a hardware wallet or a smartphone wallet, for example, a Bitcoin wallet, that wallet, what it's supposed to do is randomly derive a private key for you that is done one time and stored within the hardware of the device, not on the app itself. And so in that way, we have a number that is owned by us, and on the other side is also a number, but one that we can share. And just because we share that number, nobody can reverse engineer to actually have the spendability, the power to spend that entry. And so that's what public-private key pairs do for Bitcoin. In part, is it sets up this ownership where I own the number. Then I share the hash of the number. So we'll talk about hash. Hash is when it goes through this equation. We can share the hash on the other side. And then the entire ledger, all the computers, they're called nodes, that run the Bitcoin software, they have evidence of the entries, the balances. The sum right now is north of 19 million, less than 20 million coins, will never exceed 21 million. So the sum of those 19.5 million coins are all assigned to different addresses that everyone knows. But who can spend them? Only the owners of the private keys on the other side of those addresses. And so that is the secure relationship of Bitcoin's private public key pair. But the technology goes back to the 70s. So I'll pause there and let you ask a question or two.
Well, let me see. Let me draw a bizarre example. And maybe this nails it, or maybe it shows that I still don't understand. So let's think you've got a forest of 21 million trees. Okay, and that represents all the Bitcoins that can ever come into existence. And then you try and locate an insect, let's say an ant, which is hiding on a leaf somewhere in one of the trees. Okay, so logically, just taking one tree, you could never find that ant because you wouldn't know which, you knew which trunk to go up, but you wouldn't know which branch or which twig to actually find the ant on. But the ant could always climb back down the tree to the ground. So in other words, you've got, going up the tree, you've got an infinite number of possibilities, but going down the tree, you've only got one route down. Does that make sense?
Okay, let me try to stick with the trees example. We have 21 million trees in a forest. Each one of them has an owner, and only the owner has the power to chop down that tree and sell the lumber from it. But each tree, there's only one axe that will work on each tree, like a key, like how there's, you know, a key opens a door, but you have to have the key. So the owners of the axes are basically doled out one at a time through the mining process. That's why mining is so important to understand, Michael. I hope that we get there today. So the mining process awards these axes, and each axe only will work with one tree. Mm-hmm. Right. And right now, the block reward is a little bit north of 3 Bitcoin. It started at 50 Bitcoin every block. And that's this declining supply schedule. But it's basically the awarding of the axes, which is the magical process of Bitcoin. And only with each one of those axes do you have access to the lumber, which is the money, the commodity itself. Mm-hmm. And if you want to sell the axe itself, you can. There's a liquid market for it. But the proof of ownership of that axe can only be proven by owning this number, this private key, and doing what we call a digital signature. Mm-hmm. So you take this private number, you sign, you basically engage in a digital signature with this number, and you prove that I am the owner of the axe. So I took the ants out of your example, but I kept with the trees. So what are your thoughts?
I think that makes sense. Yeah, I think I get that.
The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by Unchained, the leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with collaborative multi-sig vaults where you hold 2 of 3 keys and benefit from a Bitcoin security partner. This is a really important feature. You can purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage with Unchained's trading desk and completely eliminate your exchange risks. Unchained also offers the best IRA product in the industry. You can convert easily your 401k or IRA into Bitcoin while keeping control of your keys. Don't pay more in taxes than you have to. Go talk to them today, unchained.com/TBL, and make sure you use code TBL for $99 off when you create an account. Imagine losing your Bitcoin fortune to a house fire or to accidental damage. A complete nightmare, right? It's estimated that over 30% of Bitcoin are lost forever, and poor seed phrase security is a big reason why. That is why we use Stampseed, a really cool DIY kit that allows you to stamp your seed into these titanium plates. So let me show you how it works. They send you a titanium plate. Part of the kit comes with this really easy to use tracker. You slide your seed phrase into the tracker. Now you take the letters that they send you, you take a letter out, and you place it into your device, and then you take this incredibly heavy duty titanium hammer and you hammer your letters into this titanium plate. Your full seed phrase will be stamped into this titanium plate that is fireproof, accident proof, damage proof. These tools have been specifically designed by people working in titanium stamping for over 14 years. So go check them out today, stampseed.com, and make sure you use code TBL for 15% off of your order. The word hash, okay? So the word hash is much older than Bitcoin, right? A few decades older than Bitcoin from a computer science perspective. And hash is a function. So we talked about the equation. A hash is a mathematical function, okay? Now, the definition that Investopedia has, which is a good one, a function that converts an input of letters and numbers into an encrypted output of a fixed length. So the key is that no matter what the data is on the left side, the right side will spit out something that is uniform in its structure, but can only be derived from one single number between 0 and 2 to the 256th power. So the action of hashing, when you hear the word hashing, what you have to think about is functions being performed, equations being performed. So the mining process itself is one grand hashing exercise. So that's one. And then I want you to start thinking about, if it's one grand hashing exercise, actually, that's where all the energy consumption is going. It's going to perform calculations. And what are the calculations? They are these hashes. But the hashes are, they're not, it's the mining process that we're talking about with the energy consumption. It's not this proof of ownership process, which also takes place via hashing, but it's not the mining process. That's the proof of ownership function of Bitcoin. So in this next graphic, I have hashing as a one-way hash function. Plain text through the function and hash text on the other side. Now, the hash function that Bitcoin uses is called SHA-256. It's within a family of encryption algorithms called SHA-2, which was invented by the NSA and published in 2001, 8 years before Bitcoin software went live and 7 years before Bitcoin's paper was written. So the underlying encryption function, SHA-256, is an NSA technology.
Right. So is this like, to draw another analogy, maybe a simple one, this is like taking the works of Shakespeare, let's say. You've got the text of a play, and you're converting that into a title. So one set of text equals a hash text, which is Romeo and Juliet, something like that.
That would be one way to think about it. Yes, and that in that way, the exact series in order of characters that is in the story run through the hash function would spit out the exact and only one set, unique set of characters on the other side, and you could call it the title to pair one with the other. And in that way, what you could, and I'll show you actually a slide here on slide 14, which might help you. This is an example taken from a NYDIG paper, NYDIG Bitcoin Financial Services provider that has some great research out there. What you see, Michael, is that the first message there where it says NYDIG spits out a SHA-256 hash. That's alphanumeric there. If you add an exclamation mark to the message, you see how it completely changes the hash.
Exactly.
So yeah. One character changes the hash. And then on the right side, what it's telling you is showing you that actually the length of the message does nothing to change the length of the hash either, where the first message is just the word it. The second message is a full sentence. It still spits out the same number of characters. Okay, so that's that is what SHA-256 is. Now, you will go back one slide to slide 13 here. You'll see that the input, if I type hello world, that this is what it looks like in a binary output. Mm-hmm. And the hexadecimal output is what the zeros and ones are encoded to show. Basically, the hexadecimal output is a language to interpret the binary. And so there are standards for the way that we turn the binary output into less characters, essentially. That's easier on the eye, but still is, as you can see, 64 characters. There are all sorts of families of ways that they express these alphanumeric strings. But it's, as you say, way too into the weeds here. I think that, do you have any follow-up questions on SHA-256 And let me just read you a definition from River real quick, Michael. Yep. SHA-256 is a cryptographic hash function which takes an input and produces an output of a fixed length. All SHA-256 outputs are 256 bits long. This process is deterministic, meaning a given input will produce the exact same output every time.
Right.
And it's in a family of function called Secure Hashing Algorithm Functions, NSA 2001. So yes, go ahead.
Got it. Okay. So what we're really establishing here is that Bitcoin is secure. Okay. There's these processes that are associated with security are longstanding and well-tested. And the whole structure is both robust and efficient. And that's what this is saying. And that's actually independent of Bitcoin's existence because they've existed in their own independent sphere prior to Bitcoin, for longer. And therefore, they are industry standard.
They are industry standard. It's proven technology, and it's technology that underpins a lot of what we already do from a technology and privacy and security perspective. What Bitcoin did and why it really shocked people, because so many people were trying, and by people I mean cryptographers. Many cryptographers were trying to come up with a way that we could have decentralized digital currency, but couldn't figure out who was going to keep the ledger and how. Mm-hmm. That is the next part of the equation here. How do you figure out who is going to keep the ledger and manage the double spend and who's double in double checking who's spending what? And what Satoshi Nakamoto figured out was a way to slow down time so that the whole world could come together every 10 minutes, and it's on average, because it couldn't be every 10 minutes exactly. There was no way to do that.
Okay, can I just ask a question at this point? I mean, one of the concepts that I introduced right at the beginning was that monetary economics essentially looks at a number of puzzles or paradoxes and establishes laws through time. And one of those is Gresham's law, and another I noted was Triffin's dilemma, etc. Now, if you think about Gresham's law, which is probably the most fundamental law in monetary economics, what it essentially says is that bad money drives out good. Now, in a way, that's accurate, but in a way, it's actually inverted, because what's actually really happening is that when it says bad money drives out good, what it's saying is that people are actually hoarding the good money. That's the money that they think is the most valuable. And they're spending the clipped coins or the sort of fudged notes that that people are uncertain about. So they want to get rid of the bad money. So effectively, what happens is that good money comes out of circulation. People sit on it, they hoard it, and all the bad stuff circulates. All the clipped coins in medieval times were the ones that had the highest velocity. People pass them on. Now, if you draw this analogy to Bitcoin, why is it? Why would Bitcoin satisfy this Gresham's law? Now, if there was a way that the security dimensions were ever, let's not say compromised, but surpassed by a different technology, which was even more secure, and that was embedded in a different coin, wouldn't that then, by definition, become the monetary standard or the asset, the cryptocurrency unit of greatest value, and Bitcoin would suddenly diminish in value? Do you see where I'm going?
Yes. The short answer is that Bitcoin has the network, and that is where the value is. And the value is actually in the stored, all the hashes that have already been performed, because that's the proof of the ledger having value and having transactions and people transacting in the currency. So the past is the accumulated hashes. That's actually where Bitcoin's value is. It's not in the fact that it uses SHA. Bitcoin could the answer to your question is that Bitcoin could easily, I shouldn't say easily, Bitcoin could adopt an enhanced security algorithm without allowing another new cryptocurrency to introduce that, because Bitcoin has the network effect and the stored hashes, the accumulated hashes of proof of ownership and a system that works and established value and the network effect of hundreds of millions of people finding value in it. It's just like if we found another metal in the earth that was that you thought or many people thought was more beautiful than gold, more durable than gold, would it necessarily automatically have a higher price per gold or replace gold eventually? Is there a way? You can't say that it's theoretically impossible that we could find a new metal in the earth's crust. Mm-hmm. And it is theoretically possible that it's more pleasing to the human spirit than gold is. Mm-hmm. It's possible. But gold also has the track record. Right. So how long could that take? And Bitcoin is a technology. So Bitcoin, because it is a live software that does achieve updates. How does Bitcoin achieve software updates? By consensus. There is a human element to this. There are programmers that work on improvements. Then they basically share those improvement ideas with others. And only when the entire network agrees that whatever changes are introduced won't affect 21 million, won't affect the mining algorithm, won't affect the usability, won't affect the backwards compatibility of Bitcoin, won't affect the person that mined Bitcoin in 2010, never sold, and has it on a computer that is so old that it wouldn't even be able to download the modern Bitcoin software. Mm-hmm. But they could still send it to an exchange because of backwards compatibility of these updates. So it's a highly scientific development process that goes on in Bitcoin. There is so much track record that you keep seeing all these new attempts. It's not just the security algorithm that it uses that makes it the best. It's that it figured out this Byzantine general's problem, which mm-hmm. I'll show you this slide. This one also comes from River, slide 15. It's a game theory problem. How do decentralized parties arrive at consensus without a trusted party? Basically, attackers are coordinating attack, but they can only win the attack on the city if they all go at the same time. But a false messenger or a spy could come and give the message that, hey, go now to one of the factions of the army. And if that one went by itself, it would lose and it would, you know, eliminate the ability of the army to win generally because they needed all parts of the team to win. And so making sure that we all communicate on the same page on what is the latest stage of all those entries in the ledger is the key. And how did Bitcoin achieve that? Through this idea of the chain of blocks. So the word blockchain, Michael, has really been bastardized, I believe, over the last several years. The word blockchain, what it really means is a chain, so connected together, a chain of Bitcoin blocks. So I'm going to teach you what a Bitcoin block is and how they are chained together so that you can understand the solution to the Byzantine general's problem, which is this coordination mechanism. So I'll pause there.
Okay. I haven't got a question on this really, but...
Then let's keep it going.
Yeah.
Okay. So Satoshi Nakamoto wrote that purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash would allow online payments to be sent directly from one party to another without going through a financial institution. So it's in the first sentence that this is about non-counterparty system. The first sentence of the entire project, Michael, is about counterparty free. Mm-hmm. So that is the premise that we have to go on here. Digital signatures provide part of the solution, but the main benefits are lost if a trusted third party is still required to prevent double spending. So that's this coordination mechanism. So we propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer network. So everyone has a computer, and every block that happens is downloaded by everybody in the network all at once, and we all check it. And this all happens more or less instantaneously, right? Because it's on the internet and it's being done by high-speed computers. Once a block is found, and I'll explain to you how that process happens, but once the block is found, it is shared by the person that found it. So the miner, the computer that wins the mining reward here. So the winner of the new axe, to use your forest analogy, the winner of the new axe shares that information that I have the axe, publishes that information, not the axe itself, but the information about it, mm-hmm. publishes it to the whole network. The whole network, all the nodes download that information. Then they verify it. So they check. Did you follow the rules? We'll talk about those rules. But the main rule being, did you take the right amount of Bitcoin from the protocol? And were the transactions that you updated the ledger with, because they do both at the same time, they win new Bitcoin and they update the ledger. That's a simultaneous process by the miner that wins the block. Did you check, are all the transactions that you included valid transactions? Meaning, did they come from the real owners of those balances? And did they spend balances that all those people actually owned? So it's a verification process, a validation, data validation process. So you hear the slogan a lot, don't trust, verify. This is that process here. Go ahead.
And what about the computational size of this? I mean, this is one of the puzzles that I've often had with crypto or blockchain. It's
very small in Bitcoin, and that is the genius part about Bitcoin. It's part of the genius about Bitcoin. The data processing of the verification is very light. Mm-hmm. And if you want to verify, meaning if you want to be an economic participant in Bitcoin, so think about an exchange, Michael. An exchange needs the blockchain. They need a node. They need to know, they need to verify everything that's going on. Right? If they receive balances from their customers, they don't want to check some website. They want to make sure that they themselves are verifying that those balances are real. Mm-hmm. So that validation process is light. And if I'm a storefront in a country in Asia, and I don't want to use a payment processor, I don't want to use a financial services provider, I just want to use my own computer, my own Bitcoin node, and I want to accept transactions from my customers, wait the 10 minutes required to verify that that was a real balance from them, and only then will I give them the product or service, and I have no exposure to any counterparty in the world. If I want to sell it for fiat, I'll have to do something there, right, with the banking system or get engaged. But if I want the Bitcoin and I don't want anybody involved, the validation process is extremely light from a data perspective. the heavy data processing is the mining. So if you want to win the new Bitcoin, you have to play the game. And that is energy intensive, computationally very intensive, and gets more so every day. So you hear about the hash rate going up. That just means there are more and more and more computers hashing, trying to win the mining reward, trying to win those new axes. So if you want to be an economic participant, it doesn't take much. You just basically need a laptop. And pretty soon, full nodes on Bitcoin phones will be more and more and more usable. But you can very easily have your phone paired to your own Bitcoin node in a way that you're the only one involved in the verification, the data validation process. So the economic participants that want financial sovereignty, the data requirements for them are light. Because of the way that the system was designed, it was designed so that anybody with a laptop could participate from a non-mining perspective. And so when we talk about Bitcoin versus other cryptocurrencies, this gives us an amazing opportunity to just establish that one of the early solutions to how we can make a better Bitcoin, Michael, was let's make the size of each block larger to fit more transactions into each block. But it's right. Nonsensical from a computer science perspective, from the usability and light data usage that I just explained to you. Now, I'm not the expert to tell you or the network that the block should be 1 megabyte versus 2 versus 4 versus 8 megabytes. I'm not the expert. Who are the experts? The cryptographers that work on Bitcoin. So those people have, through time, established the block size and the data requirements, and they have made improvements to the way that the data gets to all the nodes. That's called block propagation. Mm-hmm. So we've had a guest on where for a couple years, her whole career was dedicated to block propagation improvements. There are Bitcoin programmers, developers working on the improvement of the protocol itself to make the software universally, basically universal in its usage, as universal as humanly possible and as light from the data usage as possible to make it really democratized.
Right. So the point here really is that if you're a holder of Bitcoin, the technology surrounding Bitcoin can improve over time, of which you're an ultimate beneficiary of, but it doesn't affect the value, or certainly doesn't deter from the value of the asset you're holding.
Exactly. And it's embedded into the current value because the network understands that it has won as the universal protocol for value transfer.
Right.
And so on slide 19, we have a great graphic that our designers at the Bitcoin layer created where we compare Gmail and Outlook customers to Bitcoin users using different wallets. And so if I'm using Gmail and you're using Microsoft Outlook, we can still email each other. Why? Right. Because they use the same protocol. It's called SMTP. It's an early 80s protocol that locked in. So ask yourself, Michael, is there going to be another protocol that replaces SMTP where all the email providers from all the time just go to the next one? Or are they just going to use this one and maybe fine tune it as the decades go on? That's how internet protocols work.
Right.
And for us to sit here and debate whether Bitcoin, the protocol, or another protocol is going to win the battle of universal value transfer would be an incredible waste of time, because we actually already have about 12 years of failed attempts and failed projects and failed improvement ideas to Bitcoin itself. Like, I have an idea of how to fix Bitcoin. They've all failed except the ones that actually don't affect the rules enough to make the network start to disagree.
Right.
At the second the network starts to disagree, hey, I don't like that rule change, it just stopped. The idea stops. Because the idea already worked. You already solved the Byzantine generals problem. So I really want to get into mining today so that we can kind of maybe solidify this process, but I'll pause for your questions, Michael.
Yeah. One of the other things that I noted in the last episode was that the other sort of law or observation about monetary economics was this whole concept of the Triffin dilemma. And I'll be brief on this because I know you want to move on, but let me just bring this out.
Please.
The Triffin dilemma is really something that emerged with the evolution of the US dollar through the Bretton Woods period. And it really came to a peak in the early 1970s, where you saw a clash between the commodity backing of the dollar with gold and the demands for the international monetary system for an elastic or credit-based currency. Okay, and in other words, the dilemma was you couldn't have both, because in order to supply dollars, the US current account deficit, or ultimately the federal deficit, had to be big, and that really surpassed the amount of gold that was backing the dollar. So that was really the issue. And it was really a dilemma or a conflict between the scarcity of commodity money and the elasticity of credit money. Now, that tension, if you like, in many ways may well have been partially, and I hesitate to say completely, solved by Bitcoin, because Bitcoin has the characteristics of commodity money with a very limited supply of 21 million, right? But it also, from what you're saying, has the elasticity of credit money, certainly in terms of its transferability through the network at low cost and in size and security. Correct?
But it's not elastic in its supply.
It's not elastic in its supply, but it's elastic in its transferability, whereas gold or commodity money never was. That's why I say it's a partial solution.
So I would completely agree with that. That because of Bitcoin's transferability, it might have solved many of the problems that prevented gold from sufficing as the ultimate backing to the financial system, right? In its failure in the 60s, altogether failure. But the countercyclicality of credit expansion, fiscal policy, monetary policy, I think that we should assume that governments will do that. And so even if Bitcoin was there and was transferable, it still wouldn't have prevented money hoarding, like you were describing there, where in a deflation you hoard the money. So that was the problem in the 30s.
Right.
That was the origin of the gold seizure, FDR. The hoarding was the problem. And so if Bitcoin is the better money, it would have been hoarded also.
Correct.
And so I don't think that Bitcoin ends credit money as a phenomenon. I just think that that's... I've thought about that as a naive way to expect the world to evolve. But I don't know if I'm right or wrong about that. I don't know if I'm being short-sighted, that Bitcoin solves the need for expansionary currencies that are basically can be created and paid back for through taxes or inflation in the future.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure it does that, but I think that, you know, that's going to occur anyway. but that in a way, supports the value of Bitcoin over the longer term. Because what you've got is you've got an alternative money, or let's say you've got money, because there's a debate about whether Bitcoin is money, but Bitcoin's an asset, I think we know that. But you've got money which is being created and being forced into the system by governments, and that is basically a cyclical process. And we know that that goes too far, and governments create excess, and that's why ultimately we know the price of gold has gone up over the long term. But then with talking of Bitcoin as maybe a more convenient asset, and one that's solved many of the problems that gold hasn't.
Yes, and let me give you another analogy for Bitcoin here, because we're talking about asset or money in part one. Well, asset is definitely the better way to understand Bitcoin and what it is, because it's this property, this number that you own. That is a piece of property. And so the entries on the ledger that are connected to these private keys, that ownership itself is an asset first. It is also money because of its transferability, but it's property first. I think that is a better way to think about Bitcoin. And so imagine Bitcoin from a gold perspective or a oceanfront real estate perspective. Okay? So compare it to these things. Imagine I have a 1,000-acre property on the overlooking the Pacific Ocean, and that on that property I have agriculture that produces, let's actually back up that example. Forget the production. Let's just say I have a 1,000-acre property with a very expansive lawn. Now, I have 1,000,000 blades of grass on this lawn, okay? I also have the house. I know that I could cut each blade of grass and sell it to the market, that it would have value if I did, okay? I'm assuming that I could sell these blades of grass. And I'm also assuming this example that they would never grow back if I cut them. Okay, so once I've sold it, it's gone. But the brilliant thing about Bitcoin is that if you have a 1,000-acre property, you can sell 0.00001% of it, achieve liquidity, and still have the property essentially unscathed. Mm-hmm. And you cannot do that with prime real estate. And you can't really do it with gold bricks. Mm-hmm. And definitely not with any sort of divisibility of Bitcoin. Right. So it satisfies this property example. But it has this money-like property. It has the currency-like property. It's a commodity with currency-like properties, Michael. Right. And yep. it is absolutely both. Because the entries are property, but they can be transferred like a current, right? As currency is basically a current that flows. That's how we define currents and currency, is that it has to be able to flow. So Bitcoin absolutely satisfies that. So in Satoshi Nakamoto's first block, and I'm going to explain to you what blocks are. I'm here in slide 21, Michael. Mm-hmm. In the first block, instead of transactions, because there were none, it was the beginning of the protocol. So it's called the Genesis block, as in the genesis of the blockchain. Mm-hmm. And instead of transactions, there was an encoded message. It was a headline from the Times newspaper, Times of London, January 3rd, 2009, Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks. So right in the middle of the 2008 financial crisis, second bailout for banks, a headline in a British newspaper, and that headline, the date, the name of the newspaper, were all inserted into block number one of Bitcoin's blockchain.
Now, is that interesting in itself? Why Why a British newspaper?
That is a topic for a different day, my friend. Yeah. It is a topic for a different day because
it's an interesting topic.
It is.
Let's keep going.
It absolutely is. The Who is Satoshi Nakamoto is something that you probably, Michael, if you fall deep enough down this rabbit hole of Bitcoin, that you'll probably end up reading some stuff yourself in your own investigation. And it's nothing short of fascinating because Bitcoin is fascinating. So wanting to know who created it is natural. I might point you to an episode we did several months ago in which we look at the earliest emails between Satoshi Nakamoto and one of the first developers that he found to help him with the project. And so I'll send you that link, but it's definitely a fascinating topic for sure. So it is, in my opinion, of incredible importance to note that Bitcoin had what appears to be a very politically economic statement in the first data of the protocol. So every person in the world that has a Bitcoin node has this encoded message at the beginning of their blockchain. And this is a serious component to Bitcoin. And I don't want to go on this lecture without establishing it, basically. Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked about what a node is. A Bitcoin node is a computer that runs a Bitcoin implementation. So the software and stores the entire blockchain. And what is the blockchain? It's a chain of blocks. And we are less than a million blocks into the blockchain, but every 210,000 blocks is when the supply introduced declines, right? So these halving events, as I'm sure you're aware of, when Bitcoin's supply that is awarded to the mining winner every block, that is cut in half. Mm-hmm. So we celebrated block number 840,000 earlier this year, which was the mining reward going from 6 1/4 Bitcoin to 3 1/8 Bitcoin every block. Started at 50, then it went to 25, then it went to 12.5 in 2016. 6 1/4 in 2020, and 3 1/8 this year. So that's the supply function. And the fascinating thing about the supply function of Bitcoin is that it wasn't present in the paper in October 2008, and then it appeared in the software in January 2009. So the supply rules, this block reward schedule, for the rest of the entirety of the protocol's future, present and future, was established in that first release of the software and has never changed.
Right. And so if we roll on 100 years, the nodes have got the capacity to hold all these blocks with all the transactions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So this next slide here, 23, is when we're going to get into the blockchain. Okay. Now, I have 17 minutes or less, so I know I'm up against it, but we are going to explain the magic of Bitcoin to you here, because I think we have a great foundation. So the blockchain is a chain of blocks. We've established that. So now I want to tell you what is in each block. So the Genesis block has no transactions in it. The only transaction in the Genesis block is this Coinbase transaction. Now, Coinbase transaction describes the reward that we've been talking about. So the transaction is a Coinbase transaction, which is, of course, where the company Coinbase got its name from. but Coinbase is a technical term to describe this one transaction. The Coinbase transaction is a transaction in which the miner awards itself, back then, 50 Bitcoin, and right now, 3 1/8 Bitcoin. So it is a transaction. It is awarded to itself, and it can add that transaction, or it does add that transaction to the ledger when it publishes that block, as we discussed, block propagation, right? So if I win, I publish, and then everybody knows this transaction. And that's how the new supply comes into being. Is that the Coinbase transaction, which is the award, is now known to everyone. As long as I'm the winner and I'm the one publishing block number one, block number two, block number three. And now I'll skip ahead real quickly. It is possible, and it does happen, that two miners find a valid block at the same time on different sides of the world. And I'll explain how that works, but theoretically it's possible, and in reality it does happen, where blocks will be found within a second of each other on different parts of the world, and then when the blocks are shared by the winners to their node neighbors, basically whoever they're connected with, that the network ends up knowing two different blocks as the next block. They both know it as valid. That's called a fork in the blockchain. It resolves by the next block, but I just want to plant the seed there to show you that this isn't some fully automatic process. It's actually a coordination mechanism. So there are periods of time in which the coordination mechanism has to take a pause to figure out what are the true balances. And that's part of the beauty and elegance of Bitcoin, is that it's slow. It's slower than you would want it to be for a fast transactional currency. But in the spirit of it being property, you have to slow it down and verify the ownership. Any thoughts, Michael?
No, I think I'm up to speed here. So
okay. How does a miner win? That's the key I want to get to. How does a miner win the reward? Okay. So I'm going to show you here. Now, the key concept here to understand is a word called the target. Mm-hmm. So we have, now you have the background in a hashing algorithm. You know it's a function. You know that a Bitcoin miner now is going to assemble transactions. By the way, where are these transactions stored? They're stored in the memory of nodes. So if I send you a Bitcoin transaction, I publish that transaction to the network, and it's stored in basically a holding area. In short-term memory. It's not part of the blockchain yet. It's called the mempool, technically, the memory pool. So there's a pool of transactions that are unconfirmed. I want them to be added to the entire ledger, right? So that everyone knows it, and you want it so that everyone knows that you're the new owner. I want it so that I know I've completed the transaction. But you and I will only be happy when it's in a block that everyone knows, right? Because that's the new established ownership. So our goal is to get our transaction into a block that everyone knows. So who is going to get that block added to the chain of blocks? A miner will do that. So a miner assembles transactions because that's their job. They assemble transactions from the mempool. And then they add the information from the previous block. Why? Because we have to prove, if we're a miner, that we're working on the block that everyone knows. So the last state of truth, which is the most recent block, we take that information from the block, we hash it, right? We verify it, we hash it. We put that hashed information into our current block. We put transactions. We put our own award. So look at the bottom portion here. The Coinbase transaction is the reward, the new supply to myself. Transactions 1 through N are the transactions that I'm assembling. It's usually a couple thousand, a few thousand transactions. The timestamp, the previous block hash are portions that we get from the network and what the blockchain that we're working with. Then the number only used once there on the top left. Mm-hmm. The number only used once is a unique number that miners can change. And so now here is the magic of mining and how it works, Michael. So our goal is to take the information in the dark blue area, run it through a hashing algorithm, and what is it going to spit out? It's going to spit out a number, right? Mm-hmm. Between 0 and 2 to the 256th power. Now, how do we win the block? There's something called the difficulty target. The target is a number between 0 and 2 to the 256th, but it's a very small number. And so what does the small number do? The small number makes it so that when we hash blocks, and remember, mining, what are they doing? Hash, 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 right? So each time they hash, they get an output. That output is a number. It's usually and almost always higher than the target because the target is a small number. So the number of times you can actually hash and spit out a number less than the target is basically infinitesimal. It's incredibly rare. It's incredibly rare to the point where you would have to do it trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of times and get lucky. Mm-hmm. And do it before the thousands of miners around the world that are also trying to do this first. So the difficulty target is such a small number that it makes winning blocks near impossible. And of course, it's not impossible because someone does it every 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. But it's rare. It's so rare that the award, the new Bitcoin, is valued today at about $200,000, right? 3 1/8 times 60-odd thousand. Mm-hmm. So each one of these rewards is worth $200,000 today, but in 2009, it wasn't even worth anything because 50 Bitcoin couldn't be sold on the market for 1 cent. There was no market that allowed that. Mm-hmm. Then somebody bought pizza and then paid somebody in Bitcoin to get the delivery to their house, and it ended up striking Bitcoin at approximately a quarter of a penny per Bitcoin. And there were Bitcoin websites at that point where people were engaging in peer-to-peer transactions, trading Bitcoin for electronic gift cards and things like that. But over time, the mining reward and the number of Bitcoin became more valuable and more valuable to the point where this process of trying to win got incredibly competitive. You could no longer do it on a laptop. That's when Bitcoins went from CPUs to GPUs. And you would have to use graphics cards to mine Bitcoin. Now you can't even really mine Bitcoin with old computers in any effective way. You have to have application-specific chips. These are called ASICs. So the chips that are application specific to SHA-256, because they're only designed to do what? Hash as many times as they physically can, because each hash is an output that is most likely higher than the target. So something that's useless. So the vast majority of hashing is quote unquote useless because it doesn't yield a number that's less than the target. Therefore, the whole block cannot be published to the network as a valid block to add to the blockchain. And so when we think about other, now bring back other cryptocurrencies, Michael, most of them don't even use a blockchain with any of this process. So when you, you know, when you mention cryptocurrencies that might have a company at the center that are keeping the ledger, it's so far removed from what this process is, which is a really a scarcity exercise. It's a computational exercise. It's a scarcity exercise. And it has become an energy arbitrage.
Right. So in actual fact, it's entirely plausible that we'll never get to 21 million coins because it's becoming so difficult in terms of technology and so costly in terms of energy.
No. The way that the difficulty works, the target works, is that every 2 weeks, and I shouldn't say 2 weeks, it's actually a specific number of blocks. So on average, that 2,000 odd blocks, every 2 weeks, the algorithm, so that everyone's node is calculating this at all times. They look back at the last 2,000 odd blocks and they calculate, did they come every 10 minutes, every 9 minutes, every 11 minutes? If they were coming every 9 minutes or maybe even 8 minutes, what does that mean? It means that there are more and more miners attempting and finding blocks faster. Mm-hmm. So the target then is decreased, mm-hmm. which makes it more difficult. So every 2 weeks, the Bitcoin algorithm adjusts its difficulty target up or down to keep the average block pace at 10 minutes. And that's why, Michael, we got a halving in 2016. We got one in 2020. We got one in 2024. Because 210,000 blocks should be occurring approximately, I don't know the exact number, but I think it's about 350-ish days times four. So really lining up with about almost exactly 4 years, mm-hmm. but it's not certain that it will take that exact, it's not 210,000 times 10 minutes. It's 210,000 times about 10 minutes because every block can come 1 minute, 11 minutes, 45 minutes. If you've ever waited for that confirmation for when you're sending Bitcoin to and from whatever address and you're just waiting for, because, you know, thinking it's going to take 10 minutes and it's that one time a day or one time a week where it takes an hour. But it's a computational lottery process. It's a random process, but it does average out to slightly less than 10 minutes per block for the history of Bitcoin because more and more miners join the network. So it's almost always more miners than, you know, the 10 minute limit. So we get blocks, under 10 minutes, 9 minutes on average. And then the target goes down, meaning the number declines and the difficulty of finding a valid hash that you can show to the network that, hey, I'm the winner, it makes it more and more difficult. So over time, we should keep to the exact supply schedule, which is that the end block reward will happen in approximately the year 2140 in 116 years from now. Approximately, but it should be more or less on schedule because of this 2 week mechanism that we have every 2 weeks.
Okay. I'm going to have to put a wet towel around my head and think about this.
And we're going to talk next week, Michael. We look forward to your question. How about we start with all your questions? I'll go back through my slides and I'll see what else we have to extract here to make it all click.
Brilliant. Much enjoyed this, Nick.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us again for part two of Teaching Bitcoin. And we'll catch you guys next time for part three.
Brilliant. Look forward to it.